Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 684.EX2822, certificate number 34836. Kevlar.
After our success on the recent show about the Bhopal disaster, I realized that...
What does success mean? We did that. We recorded the show about a chemical leak like a few weeks before it was timely.
Is it timely now? Did something happen?
East Palestine, Ohio.
Oh, there was a giant chemical leak. And now people are going to think we did that show in response to it.
Correct.
But it predated it.
Yeah, by about a month, maybe.
That's the danger of pre-recording shows.
That's the danger of being incredibly like prescient and in tune with the cultural zeitgeist like we are.
Yeah.
We knew Bhopal was coming back.
Well, Bhopal's back and Tony's got him.
In the Midwest.
I felt like the success was we talked at length about chemistry and just had a wonderful time. And so I thought, well, why not just start doing all chemistry shows?
Yeah, I can't think of a single downside.
Right. I know so much about chemistry and you presumably do too.
I took 2 years of AP chemistry. Does that count?
Oh, AP chemistry. No
look,
kidding.
Oh, look who's here. Mr. AP chemistry.
Did you take every AP class that was available to you?
You have to choose. You don't have time to take chemistry and bio and physics.
You don't?
Well, maybe one does. I didn't. Maybe Doogie Howser did.
what did you take regular chemistry and or regular bio and physics in order to have AP chemistry?
No, I think I just chose. You had to take two higher level classes in one to graduate, and I chose chemistry, but I'm not sure why.
Yeah.
It seems, in hindsight, it maybe is the least interesting one. No offense. Except in the case of this episode and also the one about Bhopal's back.
I took AP history, which seemed like...
Good for a future podcaster.
That's right. AP chemistry. Boy, I never even went into that section of the school.
Because it smells weird.
I was like, I increased my pace as I had to get through there on my way to the student
center. It smells like there might be stoichiometry going on here. No, thank you.
Yeesh.
A mole of something.
I took basic chemistry.
Like no acids?
No.
My school could not afford samples of strong and weak acids.
We just worked with bases. It was really a limited thing.
Based chemistry starring
it was
John.
So based. No, I took I took chemistry for jocks, whatever that is.
Chemistry for jocks? Like you learned about like that stuff you have to put on athlete's foot?
It's rocks for jocks, except it was socks for jocks. I don't know what chemical compound rhymes with socks.
What is
it? Jocks.
Well, yeah, there is no chemistry word that rhymes with socks.
I bet we're going to find it. Somebody's going to write us.
Somebody's yelling it right now, yeah. And we can't hear you because you're in the future and we don't know or care about you.
It was a situation where it was clear I needed to take chemistry. There was a chemistry class that was designed for people that didn't really intend to take chemistry. It was taught by a guy named Putt Middleton.
His name was Putt?
Putt. And Putt Middleton, I thought, was a great teacher. I enjoyed his class. And then one weekend, he got in his small plane, as a lot of Alaska chemistry teachers do. And on Friday night, he took off in his small plane to go out fishing or something. And his plane disappeared in the clouds. And was never found.
What?
And so the,
did you have a sub on Monday?
Yeah. So on Monday there was a sub, and then about a week, and the sub was just like, play with your fingers, because I don't know anything about chemistry either. And then about a week later, the vice principal came into the class and said, Mr. Middleton is just gone.
He's in some muskeg somewhere.
And the Civil Air Patrol can't find him, or they don't even know which direction he went. And so here's your new chemistry teacher.
Did it look like Putt Middleton, but in disguise?
Nope.
Had he faked his own death for tax reasons?
Putt Middleton changed his pronouns, and from that day on, we were...
I'm going to Google...
Call him Mrs. Pendleton.
Putt Middleton.
So...
You didn't falsify his name for this story either.
No. Putt Middleton was he was the man.
But you're talking about somebody's tragic death. Somebody's going to know Putt, no?
We don't know if it was his death. He literally disappeared into thin air. This is a thing that can happen in Alaska. That does not happen.
One out of six Alaskans will fake their own death at some point in their life.
I mean, it happens, right? You fly out, and then I don't know what happens. Your Piper Cub gets abducted by aliens. You go straight up into the heavens.
A Chinese spy balloon got him. A flying moose.
So suffice to say, I did not learn chemistry at the hand of a master.
I just got it, by the way. Redox for jocks.
Redox for jocks. Thank you.
That might be about as good as you can get, though.
There was my lab partner in my chemistry class was a girl who wore a Levi's jacket that had a ZZ Top pin on it. And at the time, that was, you know, around the ZZ Top Eliminator era. And it was not entirely... like the coolest pin you could have on your Levi's jacket. It wasn't the Clash, let's say, the only band that mattered.
But for a girl in Anchorage, was it top 2 percentile?
Well, the thing was, like, this was a very basic science class, and
we've heard.
Yeah, and I considered myself to be a member of the AP history intellectual elite at my school. And so my feeling, even though I was not a scientist, was that this class and all the people in it were, you know.
Beneath your notice?
A little. But my lab partner, this girl in her, and she also, I think, maybe didn't actually wear like a feathered roach clip in her hair, but something close to that. I just felt like she was a ZZ Top pin on the jacket, even though I liked ZZ Top, I just couldn't quite figure out where she was coming from. But I realized many years later, 25 years later, that
was Sarah Palin.
I should have asked her out. I really liked her. I thought she was pretty.
Just start a conversation about ZZ Top.
She was funny.
It's right there.
We worked together, you know, on lab stuff, and we had a good time, but I just couldn't get over myself, Ken, is what it was. I couldn't get over myself, and now I regret it, and who knows what kind of life we could have had.
It's hard to overstate the degree to which guys will just be clueless, you know, and then just decades later they will think, well, you know who I should have asked out.
Well, and I'm thinking, like, she was probably trying to get me to ask her out. That's why I have these feelings.
That's why she got this ZZ Top pin.
Yeah, she was like, I know he must like ZZ Top.
He's got a beard.
I did.
You did not have a beard.
I did air guitar to ZZ Top, I have to admit.
I have legs. I know how to use them.
Yes. I'm a sharp dressed man, alas. At least now.
Well, if she's listening. If she's listening.
Yeah. I don't know if she would even recognize herself. You think back.
Do you know her name?
No.
You don't know her name?
No, and I don't even know if I looked through the yearbook whether I would be able to remember, unless she had a roach clip feather in her hair in her yearbook picture, I'm not even sure I would know to know her.
This is extremely tangential, but I was like,
no.
I was signing, so we'll cut this out. Don't worry, we'll cut this out. I was signing books in a book line after an event a couple weeks ago, and this woman comes up to me, and it's my, as you do, and it's my ninth grade biology teacher.
Wow, cool.
And she has a picture, she's printed out a picture of the class, and I'm like, wow, thank you. You know, I called her by what had at the time was her married name and is maybe no longer her married name. And then I was like, well, that's kind of awkward. What if she's not married to that guy anymore?
You can't think that far.
It's too late.
You just have to say what you say.
Well, I'm gonna sign a book to her.
Oh, I see.
You're signing a book to your ninth grade teacher. Do you write her first name? Weird, right?
No, you say,
hey, Deb, what's up?
Mrs. Jenkinson.
So I wrote down Mrs., her last name at the time, and then I was like, that's not her last name anymore, and I just crossed it out and put Deb like it was a bit, but either way. But I later, on the plane, I pull out this picture, and it looks, it's odd. Like, it looks possibly photoshopped, but I don't, or like, you know, like some kind of a sharpening engine has gone in and tried to make make an actual picture out of it.
Yeah.
I actually can't tell what's going on, but it's possible this woman just falsified a picture of my ninth grade bio class, but I could remember the names of everyone in it.
Wow.
And their reputations. Like, you know why I don't trust this guy? Or you like, you know what this guy carved in the men's room stall.
That's good.
But you think cool. But you don't have, I guess I went to a smaller high school. Like my graduating class was like 80 people.
Yeah. I went to a massive urban high school.
Yeah. That explains it.
So no, I don't think I could. And the thing is, I never socialized with her, never saw her at a party. It was just this class. I have a very clear picture of her, but I don't know if I could recognize her from a picture. It's weird. I'm going to actually do that. I'm going to go right now in the middle of the episode.
I'm going to go do hypnosis.
No, I'm going to go find my yearbook and I'm going to see if I can find her. And I'm all, did you find anything about Putt Middleton while I was talking?
Nothing.
Wow.
He has managed to evade the internet as well. I assume it's spelled like a golf putt, right?
Yeah. Well, that's what we, I have no idea what his real name was. It has to have been a nickname.
You called him Putt?
Putt Middleton.
I see. We would have said Mr. Middleton in my school.
Well, sure. But if you have a teacher named Putt, are you not going to call him Putt?
Wait. Here's something.
Wait. Here's something.
Could it be Charles Putt Middleton?
It has to be. Is it a story about an Alaskan chemistry teacher that disappeared? Because I'm going to say it's got
to
be.
It appears to be about Washington era indigenous peoples.
Okay.
Could he have like married a Duwamish girl?
It's entirely possible.
Unless
this happened in 1890. Well, anyway, charging forward.
Nell Price, born 1910, died 1989, married Charles Putt Middleton. Could he have married somebody with Duwamish tribal blood? Maybe so.
He wasn't that old, though. He was probably 35 when he died. And yeah, I'm saying that.
He died in
1984.
So you think he was born around 1950. He would not be 40 years old. This could have been his parents.
Yeah. Sure.
His parents, Charles and Nell Middleton.
If your name is Charles Putt Middleton, what would you name your son?
Yeah, would you want your
son? Also, Putt.
Maybe you wouldn't want your son to be named Putt.
No, you'd eliminate the Charles and just go straight to the Putt.
Oh, here we go. Here's a book by, this is it. This is some kind of a business self-help book. Have you read The Talent Code, Greatness Isn't Born, It's Grown, Here's How?
No.
You can't say here's how at the end of your title.
Here's how.
:, here's how. Maybe he's making a toast to himself.
Did you buy that at a convention?
Yes. And then I signed it to my ninth grade teacher. But at the end of this book, he must be a product of the Atlantic Alaska Anchorage Public Schools because he thanks a variety of teachers. Nell Simmons, Pat Jobe, Hope Vig, Nina Prokish, Katie Hannon, Carolyn Crosby, Martha Hirschberger, Marilyn Cimino, Gordon Spidel, and wait for it, last but not least, Putt Middleton.
Right at the end. What is this author's name?
Daniel Coyle. He wrote a Lance Armstrong book that's a New York Times bestseller.
Wow. Dan Coyle.
But if he wrote it before the testosterone stuff.
High five.
Maybe has not aged really well.
Well, what I missed, and I think probably if Putt had survived.
What he would have immediately taught you that day.
I might have.
That Monday he was going to be like, I'll teach these kids about Kevlar if I don't. If I don't slam my plane into a spy balloon.
That's right. If his plane had been made of Kevlar, maybe he'd be here today.
Oh, too soon.
What I never did was the nylon rope trick. Now, do you remember the nylon rope trick as something that you did?
Is this a ZZ Top record?
The nylon rope trick. No, it's actually, it's something that you might find at a wife swapping party, which you and Mindy are never going to attend because why would you swap perfection?
Exactly. I already have Mindy and our thruple, Rosalita. And why do we don't have to go to these parties anymore?
Rosalita, jump into my fire.
What is the nylon rope trick?
The nylon rope trick is a chemistry demonstration of how, let's see. It is a demonstration of a kind of interfacial polymerization. Now, do you know what a polymer is?
It's like a long molecule of the kind that plastics are made, right?
Right.
And it doesn't really exist in nature. You kind of have to trick molecules into making a polymer because they really don't want to. It's like getting a kid out of bed on a cold day.
Well, it's a polymer is a macromolecule, which is made up of little parts, repeating.
Like a components. Lego? It's like a Lego molecule?
Yeah. And you have to, if you can get it to clump together in this way, you can make these giant molecules that have like...
crazy properties.
Yeah. And molecular weights that kind of defy expectation.
But you know, all sizes of molecules are okay and healthy.
That's right. We celebrate all molecules here. The nylon rope trick... is a trick where you that you can do in any kind of chemistry classroom where you take a
if your teacher hasn't been taken by your teeth.
If your teacher is still there, if your teacher is not just a sub that for whatever reason wasn't working that quarter.
If your teacher's not at the bottom of some kind of muskeg lake.
But you take like an aliphatic diamine, let's say, or a diacid.
And what else are you going to be doing with it?
That's right.
If you got a spare one.
You got them sitting around. And one of them is water soluble and one of them is not.
Okay.
And you put them, you take the water soluble one and you put it in a beaker. This is what beakers are for. And then you put the non-water soluble one in there. Now,
you said you weren't into chemistry, but you know what beakers are for.
Oh, sure. I've got beakers all over. You know, I make iced tea in a beaker.
Beakers for days. And you know how to use them.
And what you find is that what'll happen is that the area where the non-water soluble and water soluble solutions touch each other,
is there like two layers? Like you put oil and water in salad dressing?
You know, one of them, I think the water is heavier than the non-water. And in the barrier between the two substances, it will form a polymer surface. But once it happens, the reaction will stop. Right? It won't then. It's not going to continue through both
because they've been divided by this new polymer.
By the new polymer,
is it essentially a solid? You've made a little solid film there.
Yes, film between the two liquids. But you can then reach in, you know, through the top liquid, grab a strand or grab the polymer, pull it out, and then the space between the two liquids will create another.
It just keeps wanting to make polymers.
And so you can
polymers all the way down.
You can wind it on a stick.
I see.
And the two liquids will continue to create this surface area at where they interact. And you can just keep winding it until you run out of fluid.
What a lovely way to spend an afternoon.
It would be such a cool science experiment. It would be the type of thing that would actually rivet me and my science partner, and we would stop being 10th grade flirters or 11th grade flirters, whatever we
want. Maybe it would like wake you up enough that you're like, you know what, Laurel?
Yeah.
I'm just going to ask.
That's a great guess.
I'm trying to think of what's a mid-80s Alaska name. You know what, Jennifer? Are you going to the party at Rex's house on Friday?
You know, Jennifer was the most popular girl's name in every state of the union throughout the 1970s.
You mean it was the name of the most popular girl in each state?
No.
We've asked all the high schools who their most popular girl is.
But the most common girl's name, and it accounts for why we, people my age at least, know so many Jennifers.
And I just assume that the world is still full of Jennifers. Like I have no awareness of the fact that you could not find a single Jennifer in any high school today.
No, they're all named Madison now.
Right. All the Jennifers became Madisons.
The Jennifers became Madisons. Anyway, this nylon rope trick was conceived in 1959 by a woman by the name of Stephanie Kwolek.
A lady chemist?
A lady chemist.
This is a bit we do at our house where anytime somebody comes up to, at a shoe store,
yeah,
my wife will be like, a lady shoe salesman? Or like a voice on the plane, hey, we're at 25,000 feet, a lady pilot?
A lady pilot?
I think it's kind of actually bad for feminism and maybe we need to stop.
No, I think it's hilarious. You know, in the 1970s, my dad had a, back in the day, I've probably described this before, but you know, he was from that era where he had a lawyer, he had a doctor, he had an accountant, he had a dentist, he had, you know, but he also had,
he got a full complement.
He had all of the, he had all of the things that you, as though you lived in a small town. And mm-hmm. I wish I had one of all these things and not just like a primary care physician that I only see once a week or
and
once a month.
And it's probably a nurse practitioner.
But he also had a carpenter and he had a mechanic and he had an airplane mechanic who was different.
I wish Putt had an airplane mechanic.
I know. Putt probably was his own airplane mechanic, remembering what I do about Putt. But he had a carpenter and his carpenter was a lady and he called her Lady Carpenter. And so he would say, Lady Carpenter's coming over to do some stuff. And then she would arrive and he would go, Lady Carpenter. And she would go, David. And it was all fun and games in 1977.
She probably liked being Lady Carpenter.
Yeah, maybe it is again. Maybe
it's like being Lady Marmalade in 1977.
Maybe if I had a Lady Carpenter and called her Lady Carpenter, she would think it was amazing. I don't know.
Karen Carpenter could have been named Lady Carpenter.
I bet she,
if she had lived. The Queen could have named her Lady
Lord, lady.
Could have named Richard and Karen Lord and Lady Carpenter.
Stephanie Kwolek plays a large role in our story.
Good. It's about time.
She was a Pennsylvania...
Dutch.
Pennsylvania baby, a daughter of Pennsylvania, who grew up with a kind of, you know, the kind of dad that would take you out in the woods and show you trees and bugs and roll over rocks and look at what was under them.
No, I don't know that.
The kind of dad that I wanted to be that my daughter consistently and constantly resists being the daughter in that story. Let's go turn over this rock and look under it. Yeah, I know what's under it. Bugs. Can I go back inside and read?
I feel like I never had the expertise to be that kind of dad. It's like, what kind of tree is that, Dad? Well, it's either a Western hemlock, a red cedar, or a Douglas fir, and I don't care to look it up.
Yeah, I'm the dad that does know, and she doesn't care. Hey, look.
We should switch kids.
Look, honey, that's a Western hemlock. And she's like, But fortunately for Stephanie, she had the kind of dad that wanted to do that, and she was the kind of daughter that wanted to know about it. And unfortunately for her, her father died at a young age, but instilled in her an interest in science and medicine. She also had an interest in fashion, which plays into this story only anecdotally in that her mother said, the problem is that you are a perfectionist and fashion will constantly be frustrating to you. There is no way to be in fashion and also be a perfectionist.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Go into a STEM field if you're a perfectionist where things either work or they don't.
Exactly. And that anecdote, I think, really, really rang true with me. Like, oh, sure, you want to go into medicine. If you're going to go into fashion, you're going to have to be ready to embrace chaos. So she did want to go into medicine, and she attended, now we're talking about, she was born in the 1920s. She's almost exactly my Uncle Jack's age.
That's very helpful for our audience who all know Uncle Jack well and can imagine that.
Actually, she's only a couple of years older than my dad. So she was born in 1923. No, younger than my dad. I'm sorry. He was born in 21. For those of you playing along at home.
Same age as my grandparents and your dad.
Yeah, she was born in 1923. And so she was going to college, which would have been in the 40s. And at the time, of course, to go as a woman to go to a science college, it was still a little bit more of a challenge. And so she attended the Margaret Morrison Carnegie College, which now has been absorbed into Carnegie Mellon, but at the time was a women's college that focused on the sciences of the women's sciences, the homemaking sciences.
Oh, is that true? It's all domestic stuff?
Well, no, because apparently the faculty at Margaret Morrison were women that wanted to push those boundaries.
They did want to turn out a generation of lady doctors and chemists.
They did. And so Ms. Kwolek graduated from Margaret Morrison and was prepared to then go to medical school. She had kind of majored in chemistry and biology because she was a nerd like you.
Yeah. my people.
And then went to kind of get a summer job in chemistry in order to pay her way through college, and went to DuPont, which was at the time at the cutting edge of these new, this kind of new chemistry, materials chemistry.
And if you live in Pennsylvania, Delaware's right there.
That's right.
Why not?
Well, okay, it wasn't in Delaware yet. At this point, it was in Buffalo, New York.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
DuPont was still in Buffalo.
Yeah, they moved to Delaware a little bit later in our story. So DuPont had been pioneering all of these new polymers, these new substances that it's so fun to think back to a time almost exactly 100 years ago when chemistry was really, making better living, literally better living through chemistry.
Until now, there's been wood, stone, and glass.
Yep.
Now there's this.
Like, now there's this.
What if you made your home items out of this?
And we've done an episode of The Omnibus about the rubber producing companies of Central and South America.
Yep.
And the dangers and threats that they produced, the wanton destruction and overthrow of governments,
and the rush of money into those places that I guess died when new polymer substitutes for rubber, I guess, were invented.
So DuPont was very interested in making a replacement for rubber
that you don't have to get from a tree.
You don't have to get from a tree. And a chemist by the name of Wallace Hume Carruthers was working at DuPont making these new polymeric substances. There were different departments at DuPont. There was the chemical research department. There was the department of, later on, what became the Department of Rayon, and the ammonia department, also a big department. The ammonia department was kind of back on its heels. Ammonia wasn't playing as big a role. They were bleeding money.
That's the department that's like, I gotta get out of ammonia.
That's right, man. I'm stuck in ammonia again. Gotta get out of here. And Wallace Hume Carruthers was the scientist that was the chemist that invented neoprene, and neoprene was effectively the first synthetic rubber.
Okay.
And Carruthers then continued working with these substances until he invented nylon. And nylon was a massive success for DuPont. It was what eventually moved them to Delaware, because they opened the first nylon producing plant.
And were they making hosiery out of it immediately? Was that like the killer app for nylon?
Well,
you don't have to make your stockings out of silk anymore?
Wallace Carruthers was working on nylon for over a decade, they saw the potential of this kind of new polymer right away. And what these macromolecules allow these substances to do is be very stretchy, very strong.
Mm-hmm.
Nylon was, although they started working on it in 1927, it was only announced in the late 30s, and it debuted at the World's Fair in 1939.
It's always the World's Fair.
Yep. And the first thing that they made with nylon was a toothbrush.
Finally.
But DuPont had done this crazy, kind of prescient thing of advertising nylon in advance of its debut.
Oh, that's like what they did with the Segway.
Yeah, that's
nylon,
right.
Nylon is coming.
You're never going to guess.
It will change your life.
You're never going to. The Segway is going to revolutionize cities.
What is it? Who knows?
Turns out not. We all thought it was going to be a hovercraft.
I see those weird guys on their solo wheels now. Maybe someday Segway-like technologies will reshape cities.
But we actually thought it was going to be a literal hovercraft.
We did.
That's how they sold it. But the debut day when nylon actually arrived as a, like, this is this new product.
End day.
The killer app for nylon was women's hosiery.
Okay.
And on the first day of its release, there was so much hype around nylon that they sold 800,000 odd pairs of nylons. And in
holy cow, that's 1.6 million stockings.
Interesting. In 1940, the only year pre-war where you could get all the nylon you wanted, they sold 64 million pairs of nylon stockings.
I guess it's immediately better than silk. It must just be both cheaper and tougher, right? Yeah,
it changes the world, and that's why in all World War II movies, the nylon stockings are
that's what the French girl wants.
Yeah, that's right. You can trade nylon stockings for almost any commodity, because then immediately the war starts, and all nylon production is then moved toward making parachute cable, parachute ropes, and nylon has a million industrial applications within the war.
Does nylon win the war?
Nylon wins the war. Although the Germans are also aware of the chemistry, they had some fairly decent chemists in Germany.
They have whatever they called nylon, Neulon.
Neulon. Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably.
Unfortunately, Wallace Carruthers was someone who suffered from terrible depression. And suffered from depression even before he went to DuPont. In fact, when DuPont tried to recruit him, he was working as a chemistry professor, and he said, "I feel like I shouldn't go to work at DuPont because it's a much more conducive environment to be a depressed professor than it is to be a depressed chemist working in a job."
He's probably not wrong. You can snow the dean probably longer than you can snow the head of the ammonia department.
Well, and that's the thing. Everybody thinks a depressed professor is glamorous and dramatic. Whereas if you've got a deadline and you're at a company, but DuPont didn't listen and said, no, we want you to come work for us. Heavily recruited him. And thank goodness they did, because look at all the nylon toothbrushes we have even today.
I'd still be using boar bristle toothbrushes if not for Wallace.
That's right. Although now, the other day I was looking for a brush, a hairbrush, and boar bristle hairbrushes are now sold at a premium because, of course,
they might be better. I don't know.
Not really better. I don't think. Maybe. Anyway,
You don't have a strong conviction about it.
I don't. That's
it's
not,
either better or not.
I'm not going to die on that hill. But Wallace Carruthers, despite having made the world a better place, did not feel like nylon justified his existence, and unfortunately he committed suicide.
Oh, wow. After the war?
Wallace Carruthers died not only before the war, but before the public release of nylon. So he didn't even live long enough to see the incredible popularity of his invention.
I mean, I know this is not how depression works, but maybe it would have cheered him up a bit to see nylon on every pair of shapely legs.
Yeah, unfortunately, even knowing how depression works, I don't know whether or not, I don't know the particular suffering of Wallace Carruthers and whether or not the success of nylon would have buoyed his fortunes. Mm. In any case, DuPont had this track record throughout the war and immediately after the war of having made all these innovations, these chemical innovations in creating these new substances that really were miracle substances in the time. And if you think about now, to live in a world without polyesters is unfathomable. Just look around the room.
I only got in my Levi's today because the waistband stretches a little bit.
Right.
If I had old-timey denim, I'd be wearing no pants right now.
I mean, this poker table top, this gaming top that someone sent us is made out of these materials.
This is not a kind of felt you find in nature.
I think probably these microphones have a half a dozen, your computer. I mean, it's all made of these materials.
Plastics, Ben.
That's right. Go into plastics. And that is what Stephanie Kwolek did. So she started working at DuPont. She actually went in for an interview with a prominent chemist by the name of Hale Charch.
Charch?
Charch. And all Seems chemists fake. Have funny names. It's just part of it. You don't go into chemistry unless you have a funny name.
Or maybe you do some kind of weird reaction on your own name.
Oh, right.
He actually had a real name.
It was Church. And then
he's like, he dipped it in some weird ester, and now his name is Hale Charch.
I think Charch kind of didn't... didn't shine her on, but said like, oh yeah, yeah, we'll get in touch. And sitting in his office, she said, well, you know, can you, I've got another offer and can you expedite this process? And he was so impressed with her boldness that he offered her a job that day.
Wow. He's like, you've got moxie.
And you'll see that her moxie plays a role in the story. She is a perfectionist and someone who appears not to suffer fools, not in a, like a roll over people kind of way, but in a get things done kind of way.
Now, it's been a minute since we've had new Omnibus shirts and merch available, John.
I am so excited that we have new shirts. I think Futurelings love our shirts, and these shirts are particularly cool.
I mean, one thing we have been doing more frequently is offering snap judgments on whether particular structure, systems, phenomenon, objects are or are not compatible with the writings of Karl Marx.
And for listeners who are not interested in things that are compatible with Marxism, we also sometimes adjudicate that things are not compatible with Marxism.
No matter which of the socio-political theories of the 20th century you subscribe to, you'll find something to cheer for on Omnibus. But I don't actually know, is selling T-shirts compatible with Marxism?
No. Not compatible with Bolshevism.
Does it depend on the shirt? Because here's the new limited offer shirts we have available right now. If you go to omnibusproject.com/store, you'll see that our friends at Mediocrity have two new T-shirts, one of which says compatible with Marxism, and the other says not compatible with Marxism.
We're trying out a new thing. I have always felt that T-shirts that had too much ink on them were difficult to wear because, you know, all that ink weighs you down.
Because they get all crispy?
Yeah, they just kind of blah. So I suggested maybe if we had a smaller little slogan that was just over the left breast.
This is more of a sporty business casual T-shirt.
Right, and then it requires that people say, what does that mean? And then you can wax poetic about how much you love the Omnibus Project, and you can display your proclivities or your political right. sensibilities.
This is going to give us some polling data. Mm-hmm. We're going to know how many people bought the compatible with Marxism shirt in black versus how many bought the not compatible with Marxism shirt in gray.
And you can buy both shirts and wear them depending on your mood that day. You can, when you're hanging out with your hippie friends, your leftist friends, you can wear compatible with Marxism. And when you're hanging out with your
parents,
yeah, or your parents or your libertarian friends, you can wear your not compatible with Marxism shirt.
And it's true that you get a 50% discount on your second shirt if you get them both, I see, at mediocrity.com.
Nice.
So if you want to make your voice heard on the tenets of Marxism and how they relate to T-shirt fashions, go to omnibusproject.com/store and start shopping.
I'm going to get one of each because I'm going to wear them depending on my mood.
The many moods of Tovarish Roderick.
That's right. And I'm going to get two for my daughter so that she's going to have to explain to her little friends, her little Montessori friends. She's going to have to reiterate all the different times I've tried to explain Marxism to her.
I'm going to get two, but I'm just going to get the not compatible with Marxism one twice because I don't want to get canceled.
She decides that she loves working in chemistry so much that she abandons the idea of medical school. Because this this universe of polymerization is kind of intellectually consuming and shows real things are happening.
Seems like the future.
It is the future. One thing about DuPont is that it's like IBM during the same kind of era, and like a lot of these big industrial companies, if you work there and invent something, the patent is owned by the company. So as we'll see, you know, think about the money that resulted from the inventions of Wallace Carruthers and Stephanie Kwolek. All of that money goes to DuPont. None of these scientists ever become incredibly wealthy.
But thank goodness the DuPont family does.
That's right. Thank goodness that DuPont...
Those yachts aren't going to pay for themselves.
Well, that napalm won't pay for itself. But, you know, you contrast that against the idea of invention now in our era of venture capitalism. Everybody with any idea of any kind imagines it to be worth $1 billion and immediately sets out thinking...
Assumes
that the products of our imagination are going not only belong to us, but are going to produce all the wealth for us. And this is an era where this sort of loyalty to a company, the idea that you're working for a company, but you invented this thing, but you did it using their lab equipment. And so...
Really, their victory is mine.
Yeah, it belongs to them. That's true even in the early days of personal computing. A lot of the cool inventions.
Well, software companies still try to enforce those laws. You know, they'll try to prove that, hey, that thing that you left us and then you made a fortune with, you must have done it on company time with your company laptop and
right.
read your employment contract. It's hard to enforce, but they try.
Are they successful? What's the last example of a company that retained ownership of a thing because they're employee use their pencils?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know how the settlements usually work. I'm sure it never goes to trial, but I don't. Yeah. In general, all those kinds of employment clauses are super hard to enforce and semi-illegal anyway. But often by the letter of the law, these new inventions do violate your thing, because even if you were working on that at home,
right,
while you were an employee of Oracle or whatever, read your deal. That's our stuff.
Now, you're opening a box over there and making a sound that sounds like a guinea pig rustling in its cedar chip nest.
This is like an ASMR part of the show.
Yeah, what's going on over there? Do you feel like there's something in that box that you need to get to?
Well, at the end of the show, I'm going to have to get it, and I don't want to have to like rip it real loudly while you're talking.
That's one of the ASMR, like one of the fun things about the end of the show. Ken's opening the mail.
This is a new thing where you get a little ASMR early as a treat.
Well, it kind of sounds... Like the tape there.
It is a polymer, yeah, for sure. This is
polymeric base.
This packing tape would not exist without, I'm sure, DuPont, leveling jungles.
Well, so a lot of things are getting made using this polymerization, and many of these polymers require very high temperatures to manufacture. They're expensive to manufacture, and they are kind of chemically volatile to manufacture because they're often using chlorine, and you know, the ammonia guys got real excited about this because
we're back, baby.
It brought the ammonia department back into the game. And so Stephanie Kwolek was sort of tasked with or working within a segment that was trying to find polymers that you could manufacture at lower temperatures, that were, you know, closer to room temperatures or slightly hotter, so that it was, you know,
cheaper and more efficient to make.
And in working with her various solutions, she discovered a kind of polyamide that had a very high molecular weight, which is to say, it's a very fat molecule.
It's a chunky boy.
That's right. It's thick but small.
It is small.
And so a lot of polymeric solutions, they're very viscous. They tend to be, or they tended to be up until this point, if you saw them in a beaker, they would be translucent, or, you know, a clear solution that has a viscosity, kind of like molasses.
It's goop. Invented goop.
It's goop. You have to heat it up really hot to get it to turn, you know, to get the molecules to chain.
Okay.
Into, you know, to perform the rope trick. And you know, the nylon rope trick was actually developed by Stephanie Kwolek and her mentor Paul Morgan pretty early on, but long before the invention of some of these later substances, in the late 50s, they devised it as just an they wrote a paper about it, just saying like, this would be a cool way to, it's an explainer, but also people can do it in high school science classes. You know, it was kind of like a fun little tweak.
Like the nylon rope trick.
Like the nylon rope trick. But she discovered a solution that did not have the properties of this sort of translucent, highly viscous liquid that they had formerly been just kind of tossing out as an industrial byproduct.
This isn't goop. We don't want this.
This is a different kind of goop, and it's a much more liquid, but you know, it's much light, thinner viscosity, mm-hmm. and it's also sort of buttermilk
colored.
Buttermilk colored and opaque.
Well, it sounds delicious. I want to try it on a salad.
It just looked like garbage to them. But she realized that it was a kind of crystalline solution, and she wanted to run it through the spinneret, which is the machine, you know, the industrial machine they have there to...
Basically does the nylon rope trick automated.
Like that's
it,
right.
It weaves something out of it to see what you get.
But, of course, this is DuPont in the era where everybody, all the other engineers, 99% dudes, are wearing horn-rim glasses, short-sleeved button-down shirts with pencil or pocket protectors, with lots of little automatic pencils. And I really want you to open that box. Just rip it. Just do it. That's
a good sound. Are they disrespecting Stephanie?
No, but they all have their little fiefdoms, right?
Oh.
The guy that runs the spinneret is the spinneret guy.
I think it's funny that this is like the equivalent of a computer 30 years later. Like, I'm going to need some spinneret time this weekend. Yeah. No, your department doesn't get any spinneret time.
And the spinneret guy says to Stephanie Kwolek, no, I'm not going to put your junky, like, discolored, buttermilk-colored goop into my spinneret because it's going to clog the...
He's like a water cooler dictator, this guy. He's a goop cooler dictator.
And sort of like the day she went into her interview at DuPont, she sort of stuck to her guns and said, I really want to move some of this goop through the spinneret. And eventually gets the spinneret guy and her, you know, immediate supervisor, two guys that look like they work at NASA.
Exactly.
Arms crossed.
Crew cuts.
Very doubtful about this. She gets them to agree to run it through the spinneret, and almost immediately, they discover that this particular polymer, a polypara-phenylene teraphthalamine.
Wow.
No, wait. A polypara-phenylene teraphthalamide. It produces this chemical structure. The crystals line up and produce a kind of fat molecule, unlike any they've seen before.
Mm.
It has an incredible tensile strength, 10 times greater than steel. It is 6 times less dense than steel. So you can have 6 times more of this.
It's lighter.
Yeah. Lighter and stronger than steel. Although it doesn't have the compression strength that steel has. It's why we don't have buildings made of this material. You can't.
What does that mean? It crumbles or something?
Well, it can't. It deforms under the compression stress, but it does have the tensile strength. You can pull it. You just can't push it. Kind of like me.
We can pull you.
You can pull me. I'm not a push me pull you.
What is it like? Is it still, you know, is it like, is it cloth like? Does it feel like polyester?
Well, no. So it comes out as a thread. Just like, I mean, you can spin it.
You can't spin it. It's not spiky. It's not hard. I guess that explains the lack of compression strength and why you can't build buildings out of it.
Yeah, it comes out as a, you know, very much like the rope trick. It comes out as a chain of molecules.
It's a fiber.
That then you, as you spin it out, it will continue, the chemical reaction will continue happening, and it will make this, what ends up being a kind of thread that then you can weave and produce fabric with.
is it immediately apparent that this is like a gold mine? I mean, if DuPont's already a military contractor.
Yes, almost in the moment, as the guy running the spinneret and Stephanie Kwolek and the other guy in the room are watching this substance come out of the machine, they all go, "Whoa, this is something new. This is something real." What they later discovered is that it performs really well in extreme temperatures. And in fact, the colder it gets, down to like, you know, close to zero Kelvin, the stronger it gets. So it doesn't become brittle in intense cold, and it can survive intense heat without melting. And it's resistant to chemicals. Now, it is sensitive to things like salt impurities. It degrades in ultraviolet light. It's not like a miracle fabric in the sense that it does everything. You can't, again, build buildings out of it.
But it's funny that it's one of these accidental discoveries.
Yeah.
It's not like Stephanie was like, you know what would be great is if I could tweak this polymer so it had a lower freezing point and blah, blah, blah. But so many of these things just are accidental byproducts.
Well, what she was working on, again, at that time, her department at DuPont, what she was working on was lighter car tires. It all starts with tires. Every advance in this country starts with someone trying to make a better tire.
Something automotive, right?
Can we get rid of rubber? Yes. Can we make tires stronger and lighter? Yes. But once they start trying to find industrial applications for this material, they find that and it's expensive to make. But there are kind of limitless applications for this fabric. Kevlar isn't really introduced until the 1970s, but very quickly starts to be used in construction of airplanes. It's very popular as a substitute for nylon in the sense that it's, you know, lighter and stronger in applications like tennis rackets and hockey sticks and HE double hockey sticks.
You can put it in HE double hockey sticks?
Yes.
You can send probably the Viet Cong to HE double hockey sticks.
You can.
But is it, so it doesn't occur to anybody that it's body armor?
Well, it does. It does pretty quickly. One of the things that they want to do with it is it's a good substitute for asbestos, which right about this time, we know causes asbestosis and is being taken out of, well, it's still being probably put into elementary schools at this point.
But in other states, it's being pulled out of them. And this is fireproof, so it's it can be asbestos-like insulation.
Yeah. And it's used in like brake pads and stuff. Hmm. But the high tensile strength and the light weight very quickly finds its way into bulletproof vests. Bulletproofing, as bullets got higher velocity and as guns got, once the gun took over the battlefield, of course, armor was no longer a factor, right? You don't see Civil War soldiers wearing armor because the only thing that can stop a bullet is steel, really. And to wear enough steel to stop a bullet,
not practical.
It's not practical. Bullets go right through, you know, ye olde suits of armor, and you know, high velocity, high caliber bullets can go right through steel plating on a truck.
Yeah.
So the era of armor
briefly ended.
Well, I mean, ended for a couple of centuries.
That's brief in a geological span.
If you think about the steel helmets that were being worn in World War I, for instance, they were not meant really to stop bullets. They were meant to stop shrapnel raining down.
Right.
You know, if somebody shot a gun directly at your helmet, it wasn't going to
ping off.
No. I mean, maybe it would protect you from glancing blows. But Kevlar had this ability to absorb these bursts of energy, like a burst of energy like a bullet hitting it. And because of the strength of that long molecule chain, disperse that energy across the whole surface of it and not be penetrated. It's one of the things about Kevlar fabric. It makes it somewhat hard to work with. It's hard to cut.
Can't get a needle through it. Just like, how did Ma Kent make Superman's tights?
How did she?
I think she had to use a tiny piece of, she had to make the needle out of Kryptonian metal from his capsule, or otherwise it couldn't have got through the Kryptonian blanket that she's sewing.
Oh, it's tough. Kryptonian blanket.
It's tough. How does Superman shave? He's got to use his X-ray vision in the mirror on his own stubble.
Gonna steal Superman's cape.
Tough life. You don't spin in the wind.
Also, Kevlar really good at protecting against, knife attacks. Right? You can't put enough. I know. That's why you're wearing your nylon hat, right? Or your Kevlar hat right now.
But, I don't want to take a knife to the head again.
So Kevlar becomes like for the first time in centuries now, a viable protection for soldiers.
Which totally changes a lot of things about combat if armor is once again a thing after taking a few centuries off.
Right. It can be and it becomes very very prevalent in police departments. It's much better at protecting against low caliber sort of handgun style weapons.
It's really shameful that the military is still taking this stuff away from our
police,
law enforcement. Yeah. Like, come on, military.
I mean, the military does use a lot of Kevlar. Helmets are made of Kevlar, and Kevlar increases its resistance to impact if you put it in multiple layers. So, I mean, the more layers you put in, if it's six times lighter than steel, if you put six layers of it, well, you're back at steel, but it does a better job of protecting against steel. What happens with Kevlar if you get hit with a bullet? And I'm not speaking from personal experience. So if you've been hit with a bullet.
I have not.
I'm talking to futurelings now. Go on our Facebook page and let us all know your personal anecdote that makes everything I'm saying personally offensive to you.
It's still gonna knock you, right? It's still gonna bruise you up.
It can hurt you, and in fact, the Kevlar can keep the bullet from penetrating, but it can do a lot of soft tissue damage because it's like a pretty serious. It's like getting hit with a pool cue, which, as you know.
I can imagine what it's like to get hit with a pool cue.
Hurts. I mean, the end of a pool cue if it was used as a stabbing weapon.
So this is not a pool table accident you're picturing.
No.
Somebody found out you were hustling them.
This would be somebody using a pool cue, but not to whack you over the head, but instead
to
jab you like a javelin or like a jouster.
Do you recommend that?
No, that's not the way to use it. You should whack somebody with a pool cue. You'll get it over their head.
Yeah, you'll get more. You'll be going faster.
But they use Kevlar in armored vehicles, in addition as another component along with steel, and also now they make everything out of it. They make canoes, they make table tennis, ping pong paddles.
You said they make everything out of it, but so far all you got is canoes and ping pong paddles.
Basketball shoes.
You've left a few things out. Oh, really? No. Athletic shoes have Kevlar in them.
Well, only recently, right? The first Kevlar basketball shoe was made by Adidas.
I wonder if some of this is kind of gimmick-oriented.
It was 2013. It was Nike that did it first.
The kind of guy who might put a Punisher skull on his truck is more likely to buy a household item if it says it now has Kevlar. Hey. Holy cow, this lemon zester has Kevlar in it.
Yeah, right?
That'll do the job.
Carbon fiber came along, and carbon fiber does, is practical in some of these applications. Yeah.
Do they use it in body armor, or is it not?
No.
It's not enough of a...
It doesn't do
body
armor the same way. The nice thing about the invention of Kevlar is that Stephanie Kwolek does not seem to have suffered from depression. and continued to work at DuPont, even though she was now the discoverer of what became a billion-dollar industry for the company, she never really wanted to be promoted out of the science.
She was employee of the month, and that's good enough for her.
And stayed in the polymer field, having saved the ammonia division as well as the Department of Rayon and all the other departments at DuPont. And then when she retired from DuPont, she continued to advise the good people of DuPont and became kind of a well-known speaker and...
I feel bad that I don't know of her. There can't be too many women chemists at her level of her generation.
Well, when she was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame in 1994, she was one of only a very small handful of women, I think only one of only four women in the National Inventors Hall of Fame. But in 1995, she was awarded the Lavoisier Medal from DuPont, which is their big congratulations chemistry medal. And she was the first woman to have been awarded that. And then she went on to receive tons of accolades. She, in 96, got the National Medal of Technology.
I hope they made all her medals out of Kevlar.
They appear not to have done, not to have thought of that.
It'd be a fun joke. Everybody gets a medal made out of the thing they invent. It's a bummer if you're getting yours for, Agent Orange or something.
It's funny that we don't think of it this way, but it's literally called a medal, which is a homophone of metal.
Mm-hmm. In American English.
Yeah, and so you have to assume that they're made of metal.
They should be.
Yeah. Metals are made of metal.
If it's made of a polymer, it shouldn't count as a metal. Are
there other English countries where metal and metal are pronounced differently?
I think in the UK, you're more likely to say metal with an actual metal. T. They don't turn their T's into D's as much.
Yeah, well, that's their mistake.
For them, it would be a homophone with like being in fine metal.
Oh, yes. You're in fine metal.
Whereas metal is homophone of don't meddle with my marriage.
Right.
Kind of a thing.
They are all pronounced the same as far as we here in the Northwest are concerned.
It's great. We speak the perfect English where all sounds become the same sound.
T, D. What's the difference?
Mary, Mary, Mary. Cot, cot, cot. They're all the same word to us.
But in 2003, she was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame, which I was not aware there was a National Women's Hall of Fame until I started researching
John,
this.
Wow.
I know. Never visited it. And looking at the inductees into the National Women's Hall of Fame, it feels like there might be an omnibus episode just about the National Women's Hall of Fame.
Is it a new invention, or is it like a suffragette era?
There are suffragettes in it.
It's based in Seneca Falls.
Yes,
it
but
looks
it
like.
Is not. It is not a suffragette era institution. It started, I think, the National Women's Hall of Fame is a product of the first generation feminism in the 1960s.
We called it Women's Lib.
Women's Lib. 1969 is when it arrived on the scene. And it has inducted your Bella Abzugs and some other feminist icons, but also has reached back into the past and brought forward Abigail Adams and Louisa May Alcott and it really, truly is a women's hall of fame. And Madeleine Albright is there. I can only imagine Susan B. Anthony, of course.
I'm looking at the introductory class of 19...
Lucille Ball.
73. And I feel like there's a couple I don't know, which means not a good ally.
Oh,
not
boo.
Not a good ally.
Boo on you.
Gotta go Google, let's see. Who here is mysterious to me? Alice Hamilton. Any idea?
Who's Alice Hamilton?
American physician, research scientist, and author. Leading expert in occupational health and industrial toxicology. See?
There you go.
I didn't know. A lady toxicologist.
Well, I think if I had looked through the Hall of Luminaries before today, I would not have known who Stephanie Kwolek was without having read her bio. And let me just say that I am pronouncing her name Qualic, but it's a Polish name with a W.
Oh, it's not QU.
No, it
I was
could
picturing
be,
QU this whole time.
I'm sure it's almost certainly Qualic.
Yeah.
Or Kvolik, even.
In the old country.
But she's an American, and I'm going to mispronounce her name just like I do everything else.
Is there any, like...
just like the, I'm sure, the short-sleeved... engineer, pocket protector engineers that work with
her. Yeah, you're saying it the same way they Qualic. All did. Stop triggering her,
hey,
John.
Qualic.
Like, is there any sense in which Kevlar has, I keep thinking about how, like, the Soviets used to complain about, like, SDI plans, you know, that missile defense would screw up warfare, even though it's a defensive weapon, it would screw up the balance of power and therefore destabilize warfare in some ways. Is there any argument you can make like that about Kevlar? Like, that if everybody's armored, it just, I don't know. I don't know what the then is. It makes everybody go turn to dirty bombs instead, or germ warfare, or
if everyone's armored,
nobody's armored.
Yeah. Well, you know,
Did bullet tech have to get better?
Bullet technology. What happened? And I don't know if it was a response to Kevlar or if it was just the natural tendency for bullet makers to want to kill things more. But bullets became then rather than looking for hard bullets that penetrated, they started making soft bullets that deformed and caused more damage when they hit.
Oh, that's nice.
You know, a deforming bullet then can expand, and that's where you get these situations where the entry hole is small and the exit hole is really big. And that may have been somewhat... No, I don't think so. I think a harder... more penetrating bullet would actually work better against Kevlar.
Right.
I'm not sure.
I'm looking at the numbers on the ammo industry. It's a $2 billion industry in the U.S. alone.
Just the ammo, not even the guns.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the Chris Rock routine about how you should just be taxing the bullets. Yeah, there's billions and billions of bullets sold every year. And most of them are going at, you know, the targets and the deer and sadly the young people that they're going into are never Kevlar'd.
Right. Yeah. I keep thinking that, don't the conservative congressmen say, well, the problem in this country is a Kevlar shortage. If all the kids had Kevlar notebooks, we wouldn't.
It's really just shameful that we're not Kevlaring our kids every morning when we send them to school.
What was nice is that, before she died, and of course she profited not at all from the billions that Kevlar brought to DuPont.
Right.
But seems not to have been dissatisfied with her lot in life at all, and was able to recognize that her invention had saved hundreds of thousands, if not millions of lives, and felt that was a tremendous accomplishment. Like, you got the feeling that
she's unlike a humanitarian.
Unlike some of her mentors, that she had made a thing that truly made the world a safer and better place. Whether or not it created
any kind of arms race.
Yeah, like a Kevlar arms race. I mean, there are other companies that got into patent disputes with DuPont, because like there was a company in the Netherlands that also sort of simultaneously invented a very similar
polymer.
But now the production of Kevlar, I mean, there's a Chinese company that makes it, and I'm sure just copied it whole cloth, literally.
I mean, the patent might have expired, right?
No, I don't think so, right? They patented it in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
With your patent extensions that you can get these days. A lot of these products, you know, were DuPont exclusives. So, like, for instance, if you're using off-brand napalm, you're not gonna clear the forests with half the staying power.
Is that what you use on your blackberries?
No, I pull them out by hand.
Yeah. And that concludes Kevlar, entry 684.EX2822, certificate number 34836 in the Omnibus. The Omnibus Project is at Omnibus Project on social media. I'm at Ken Jennings. You've been hearing from at John Roderick. Talk about Kevlar. You can email us, jointly at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Physical items may be sent to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Sharon sent us an International Peace Garden postcard. Can you, off the top of your head, tell me where the International Peace Garden is located?
Here, in Seattle.
There is something similar up by Blaine, isn't there?
Well, there's that. There's the Peace Arch.
Oh, yeah.
But isn't the International... What's that place over by the U District where people hang all those paper cranes? There's some sort of Hiroshima...
Under the Aurora Bridge?
No, it's like over by the University Bridge. There was that park that kind of looked Chihuly's blast furnace.
That's still there, right?
There's the Hiroshima Memorial in San Francisco, but that's not really international peace. That's much more Japan peace.
I'm speaking of the International Peace Garden in the Peace Garden State.
Peace Garden State.
For 100 peace points, John Roderick, what is the Peace Garden State?
Peace Garden State. New Jersey.
North Dakota. North Dakota's the Peace Garden State.
Peace Garden State. Because
they literally have nothing else to put in their nickname.
Peace Garden State. I thought their motto would be North Dakota doesn't suck, it's South Dakota that blows.
The second best Dakota. easily in the top two Dakotas. No, there's a botanical garden on the border of Manitoba and North Dakota that's, I'm sure by regional standards, a pretty big draw.
Yeah, well, in Manitoba and North Dakota.
That's what I'm saying.
What else you got?
But Sharon is the one who sent us that pun of the day calendar. I don't know. Have you been using that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do we have that here somewhere?
Here. That's right here.
Are you pulling off a pun a day?
No, I hate puns.
Sharon says, thank you so much for talking about the pun calendar. Oh, hey, we're doing it again. Now you can send us a thank you postcard for this.
That's right here. Love you s'more.
And then Catherine, I don't know. Yeah. Why don't you find out what today's pun would be, John? Should this be a recurring feature?
Today's pun. Is.
Are you just going to go to January 1st or are you going to go to the correct day in February?
Today's pun. I made some gumbo with only okra and sausage.
Wait. Should I try to guess?
Hang on.
Okay.
I made some gumbo with only okra and sausage. It wasn't bad and wasn't good. It was just.
Blank. This is a match game.
Yeah. Okra and sausage. It wasn't bad and wasn't good. It was just...
Whew. I don't know if I have a...
Sausage and okra. It was... not good,
shrimpless.
But...
I give up.
Mediocre.
I thought it would be a word that wasn't in the setup.
No, sorry. It was in the setup.
Shouldn't it be, I made a gumbo that had less okra, or...
I got my paycheck and the envelope was full of parsley. Someone
garnished my wages.
There you go. Hey. Good job, Ken.
I'm one for two. Catherine of West Virginia is the one who in years past has sent us a dodecahedral calendar. Do you remember these?
Oh, yeah.
It's filled with, hard to say, something ASMR-y. Beans? Dried beans?
Might be radon.
Might be buckshot.
Chips.
Buckshot? Yeah, asbestos? Hard to say. But here is our 2023 dodecahedral calendars. Thank you so much, Catherine. If you have similar items to send, again, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Find your fellow futurelings online. There's a Facebook group and perhaps a subreddit. Who can say?
There must be a subreddit.
Your office, your employer might have a Slack just dedicated to Omnibus?
Your employer,
I don't know,
might block you being able to visit any of these sites.
Your employer might match your donations to our Patreon at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Check and see if your employer has a podcast sponsoring matching program and double your donating power of your gift.
That's right. Do you think there is one where a company would match your podcast donation?
Maybe. Like, imagine a small business owner who just loves podcasting.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, he's a dentist and all his hygienists, he's like, hey, if you guys donate to a podcast Patreon, I will match that up to the first $100 every calendar year. It's easy to imagine a podcast-loving dentist.
I like that.
I would like to go to a podcast-loving dentist. If you're a podcast-loving dentist in the Seattle area, I'm not married to Dr. Kim, my current dentist. I'll switch.
Maybe I would, too.
The dentist in our neighborhood was, which we used to go to because it's literally a block from our house, was named Dr. Dull.
Yeah.
But Dr. Dull recently turned in his incredibly dull instruments, and now it's a less comically named dentist in that spot.
Do you want to know the funniest thing?
Yeah.
My dentist in high school was named Dr. Boring. No kidding.
I mean, if you're going to totally be, if your surname is Boring and you're going to go to some medical practice,
what are you going to choose?
Yeah, it's not funny if you're a radiologist named Boring, but like at least if you're a dentist, it switches the meaning of boring from tedious to drilling.
Yeah, it would be really funny if you were a mine engineer, like a mining engineer.
Well, remember how Elon thought it would be funny if his tunneling company was called the Boring Project or whatever it was?
He's such a funny
he's so
guy.
Funny. Like it's funny how his tweets are always at the top of my feed. As long as he tells his engineers to amplify his jokes 1,000-fold.
What a kook! What a nut!
What a nutty guy controls all the discourse in social media. I mentioned the Patreon. If you have considered in the past supporting the Patreon, you are now missing out on a backload of, I believe, 40 bonus shows.
Whoa.
That you have not heard.
Whoa.
If you are finding your omnibus content a little bit thin, becoming a Patreon supporter opens vast new horizons of frankly pretty tedious content.
You could go back and listen to 2 omnibus a week for almost an entire year.
You could live in a cave and pretend that Weekly Omnibus is not happening.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you could just have ChatGPT generate 26 more shows.
Yeah, we were wondering, we were thinking aloud, and rather than actually go and look this up ourselves, let me just pitch this to our listeners. How many typewritten pages would a transcript of a single Omnibus episode be?
John's asking because he wants a bespoke set of bound omnibus volumes on his shelf.
I don't want it personally. I want to make it and then sell it. So how many episodes of Omnibus transcribed could you put in a single volume? And how big of a 5-foot shelf of books would the complete Omnibus record be?
A moment's Googling makes it seem like an hour of speech is about 6,000 to 8,000 words.
Okay. That's not many pages.
It's not, right?
No.
Like you can get about 500 single spaced words per page.
Right. So you're talking about 10 pages.
12 pages of single spaced, of tight single spaced type.
Well, but if you were.
If it's dialogue form.
Yeah, you're writing it as a play. So let's double it. So 12 pages. 12 pages. I mean, you could put quite a few.
No, it's more than that. It would be 24 pages.
Oh, okay.
It's 12 pages single spaced. So.
So 24 pages. You could put 30. A lot of omnibus episodes into a single volume.
Could you put,
although there are hundreds,
this is the 540th omnibus. You could not have 540 times 20. That's
no, they'd have to be
15,000 pages.
It would have to be a shelf of books.
But that's just an encyclopedia set.
Yeah, if we printed them using some kind of digital printer and bound them in Corinthian leather.
In the darkness where the shadows lie?
Yeah. Think about that. Think about what a sexy set of books that would be. You could pull it down off the shelf and go, let me consult my omnibus.
Encyclopedia Britannica has how many pages? Encyclopedia Britannica is about 40 million words.
Yeah.
So if an hour of conversation is 7,800 words, how many omnibuses would we have to record? We need to get to 5,000 episodes to duplicate the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Whoa.
Is that true? We're off by a factor of 10.
That's fantastic. And you know how much space an Encyclopedia Britannica takes up. I bet you know to within an inch.
Well, you got the Micropedia. You got the Macropedia.
You got the yearbook.
The 2-volume index. Yeah, and then you got to keep the yearbook. Did they ever do yearbooks or was that just no. World Book? Britannica did yearbooks, huh?
Oh, no. Maybe Britannica didn't.
They might have.
Yeah, no, wait. Did Britannica do yearbooks? This is the best part of this show.
I want Britannica to do my high school yearbook. Like, why is Jostens taking over that market? I think Encyclopedia Britannica should be able to do reference book formatted high school yearbooks. Because that's what the kids like.
Yeah, Britannica did yearbooks, of course. I mean, I think I have more than one.
The yearbooks were singularly unhelpful. I mean, I get why people bought them, because they'd be like, oh no, my encyclopedia is out of date. It doesn't have Richard Nixon in it.
Right.
But then you still have an encyclopedia, and then a book of things that happened in 1971.
Right, so you would
What's
need
that
to
for?
Know. You'd need to know, like, when was Kevlar patented? Oh, 1971. No, 69.
My parents have a room in their basement where I often stay when I'm out on the Olympic Peninsula, and they have at some point they got a late 60s era world book set. I'm surprised they only have one, but they have a bunch of yearbooks. So I was going through world book yearbooks for the mid 60s last time I was out there.
Pretty cool.
It's fascinating. I mean, there's a lot of editorial oversight because it really is kind of a year in review. It really is kind of a, let's talk about the nonfiction bestsellers of 1972. Well, let's talk about developments in architecture.
Right.
You know, have you seen the pavilion at the Osaka Expo? So it you know, it's not, you know, it's in real time, they're having to make encyclopedia-like judgments on what enters the canon.
When was Jell-O salad invented? I mean, it transformed the Mormon world.
Did Stephanie Kwolek invent it?
I doubt it.
She's got some weird goop. She puts it in a spinneret and it comes out with fruit cocktail quivering in it.
Well, we know that it can't predate Jell-O.
Oh, I see. You're saying the recipes themselves.
At some point along the way, the world book must have an entry that says there was before Jell-O salad and there was after Jell-O salad. Otherwise, the state of Nebraska would have starved to death many, many decades prior.
Gelatin salads actually... A gelatin salad won a Better Homes and Gardens recipe contest in 1904.
Whoa, okay.
But that's way before the Jell-O brand existed.
But still, gelatin salad, 1904, that predates the discovery of the Pacific Ocean, if I recall correctly. It
predates your Uncle Jack.
It does. Although my grandmother was already in Paris by that time.
Not eating Jell-O.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We may run out of Jell-O salad any time and all perish.
No.
We hope
and save the retro salads.
We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, in the absence of Jell-O salad, we wish you many goods and cheese. And hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Odyssey.